and welcome to another episode of Lie, Cheat, and Steal, a bi-monthly podcast about liars, frauds, thieves, and bullshitters. My name's Pat Sirois. You can also find us on Twitter at LCS Podcast and on TikTok at Lie, Cheat, Steal Podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave us a five-star review wherever you're listening to this, or you can subscribe to our Patreon, where we release two more episodes every month. That's at patreon.com/liecheatandsteal. And as always, I'm here with my co-host, Kath Barbadoro. Kath, how you doing?
Hi, Pat. I'm good. It's a beautiful day outside. I'm excited. I'm at work recording this. I stayed late in my office. I'm going to ride my bike home after this. We just did a whole episode about ghost kitchens, and now I'm thinking about food, and I'm figuring out what I'm going to eat for dinner. Very exciting.
Yeah, I was thinking about that fried chicken you were talking about, the chicken place.
And Shit, that sounds good. Pecking House is on my way home. I might stop at Pecking House. It's kind of expensive, though. That's a problem.
Oh, yeah.
It's worth it, but it's like worth it for a treat, you know? It's not worth it for like an everyday occurrence. But yeah, man. Listen to our Patreon. Subscribe to our Patreon to hear about the evils of ghost kitchens and also some really good fried chicken they make in Brooklyn.
Yeah. You get all the info, all the great places to eat and the great scams to avoid over there on the Patreon. Yeah, we went and got Raisin Cane's today. Nice. A little pedestrian, but I've been cooking a lot lately, like in the house.
What have you made?
My body
lately?
Was just. So I made, I've been making a lot of fun stuff because I've been cooking a bunch, but I made like, I always do stuff that's like more like, I guess you could say the spices and shit I use is more Southern or like Mexican flavors, but I actually made some like pasta the other day. Not made pasta, but I got some like Italian sausage and I made my own little sauce guy where I used like the tomato paste and some water and just like, I cut up carrots and did all that. I've never really, Italian flavors isn't something I've ever really messed with. It's always been like Southern barbecue seasoning and like, Mexican flavors and like Chipotle and shit like that. I made a yogurt marinade the other day. That was really good.
You marinate in it? Chicken?
It was chicken thighs, and I did them in the yogurt marinade, and I had Chipotle in there, like fresh Chipotle peppers.
Yeah.
And boy, that went hard. That's real. I'm going to do that again.
Yeah, yogurt, buttermilk, like anything with that like lactic acid in it, really good. Really, really good marinade. Yeah. Delicious.
I left it in there overnight. That was cool. Sid's mom, like, emptied out her freezer to us the other day. She was just like, hey, I got all this meat. We were like, yeah, we'll take that.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was like a lot of like flank steak kind of deals, you know, which are the best things. And I made like a little like off the cuff pot roast just to like put other things in there, wrapped it up in tin foil with potatoes, carrots, and onions and celery, a couple pads of butter. Doing it there for like an hour and 45 minutes, and like, boy, that was delicious.
God damn, we gotta stop talking about food. I'm so hungry.
Yeah, right? What are we doing, man? Let's see. Speaking of food and delicious food, a food that we all enjoy comes from a country that plays a very central role in today's story.
Okay.
And it kind of factors in a large scale and like a big picture kind of thing.
Interesting.
It factors into our story. So cocoa, right? We all like cocoa. We all like chocolate.
Delicious.
A lot of it. Yeah, delicious stuff. A lot of it comes from the West African country of Ghana.
Okay.
And so, today we're going to be talking about a guy who I think the only thing that keeps him out of good guy club material is that a couple regular people got hurt by a scam. Mm. But even then, he got so many. We're talking about that dude, a slept on a guy I'd never heard of. And this dude should get way more exposure. There's a book out that I'll reference here in a little bit that's out now that I think you should go check out. That's what kind of shed light on this guy. We're talking about. His name is John Aka Blamiza.
Okay.
And Blamiza. It's a hyphenated last name.
Never heard of him. I'm excited for you to tell me about him.
Yeah, John Aka is depending on who you ask, he is a custodian to the wealth that was squirreled away at a Swiss bank. It was the entire wealth of Ghana, about $30 billion, put into a Swiss bank by their ex-president. Mm-hmm. And on that ex-president's deathbed, he told John Aka Blamiza that there's the money, you're the sole trustee, and it turns out...
You're the sole trustee of Ghana now.
You own Ghana.
That is being the president is, right? Is you just have the bank account of the country.
Yeah. When you get elected president, they give you the debit card.
Right. The country's debit card, yeah.
Oh, man. So
there's one account that's always trying to get you to submit your receipts, but you have the credit card.
Yeah. Oh, damn. Yeah. Sometimes, like, the country goes out for a trip and then you leave the debit card back at the embassy and you're like, damn it. I don't know, guys.
Yeah.
Somebody Venmo me. I'll get you back. But yeah. So he was basically told that he was the sole trustee of this bank account with about $30 billion in it. The only thing is, long protracted legal battle to get the notoriously untrustworthy Swiss banks to give him this money. And to fight that battle, he needs your help. He needs you to invest in him. Throughout the Philadelphia area in the 1970s, he racked up some numbers. So, yeah, and this guy's a larger-than-life character. He's in the vein of the fake Sheik. He's in the vein of, like, who's that guy? The guy from Mali that defrauded the Emirati Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Just larger-than-life character. So let's just hop to it. So John Akablemaiza was a Ghanaian-born, Philadelphia-based con man who orchestrated an elaborate and hugely profitable investment scam in 1970s Philadelphia. While his scam started local, it soon went worldwide, pulling in, it's an estimated, they don't really know how much, but it's between $100 to $300 million.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's a heavy hitter. These guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this guy ain't fucking around. In many ways, his scam serves as the prototype for the infamous Nigerian Prince email scams in the early days of the internet. If you're not familiar with those, that scam featured, it was a supposed deposed member of the Nigerian royal family pleading for help via mass email to be rightfully installed back on the throne. Investigators who helped him finance his legal battle for reinstatement would be rewarded tenfold, twentyfold, once he was back in power. This scam, like many other international frauds, plays upon the ignorance of Westerners and the general global indifference to the affairs of the African continent.
Mm.
The Nigerian monarchy, which is funny, so I looked it up. There was a Nigerian monarchy for about 3 years. It was after the 60s when they separated from Great Britain. And before that, technically the king of Nigeria was Queen Elizabeth II.
Mm.
So like, that was, yeah. So there's, if you're currently talking to a Nigerian prince or a Nigerian former king, cut it off. They never actually existed in the modern world.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
Nigeria, by the time the email scam went around, Nigeria had been democratically ruled for 4 decades. So like,
yeah, people, but that's, you know, the thing is he was, they would say they were like deposed, you know, like,
yeah.
They would say like, oh, you know, I'm a distant relative of the royal family or whatever. I feel like it definitely does rely. It does play on the ignorance of the Western world of what's going on in Africa. I feel like it's also an interesting, the Nigerian prince scam, which this guy sounds like he was doing too, it's an interesting play on like an investment scam where like often people will, the scam will be that you'll be investing in some business plan. And then the idea is that like, you know, you're going to get your money back tenfold because this is such a great idea. But the Nigerian prince thing and what this guy did is it's like, the guy himself is the investment, you know? It's like, I have access to all this money. I just can't get it right now. So you're giving me like a bridge loan that I'm then paying several 100% interest on. And that's how you get your money back. Which like, it's an interesting spin on it. I feel like it probably depends on the type of person, which one would be more effective. But you definitely have to be like very charming to pull this off in person.
This dude is this guy fucking rules. Just as far as like charisma goes, like it may not be in the good guys club, but it is in terms of like the this guy fucking rules club.
This guy
is for sure in it. People, this scam went on for 15 years. We're going to get into the deets. But even at the end, there's people who were like, no, he just needs some more time.
It's coming through. Yeah. It's just not.
And he knew exactly. But you talked about like, you know, it plays upon Western ignorance and a lot of times like Western guilt.
Yeah.
And so Blamiza's scam wasn't very different. He played upon Ghana's political instability and numerous failed regimes to claim to Westerners that he needed investors to fund his legal battle to retrieve billions of dollars squirreled away in a Swiss bank by former Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah. So Blamiza told potential financiers that Nkrumah had told him about the secret bank account on his deathbed and entrusted it to him to secure the funds and help guide Ghana to a golden age of economic prosperity. Investors were sold on the idea of either A, like assuaging their white guilt by helping an impoverished African nation, or B, looting a developing country and securing positions and contracts within the newly formed government.
Right.
And
it works on numerous different perspectives and consciousnesses.
Yeah.
Like, Yeah, in Philadelphia in the 70s, like you could get people in like sort of a pan-Africanism, like black power thing. You could get guilty white liberals. You could get just like cowboy profiteer type people. Like you got everybody.
Wants
you got
to
everybody.
Get in on, yeah. like there's something kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity with state formation. like if you can get into the ground floor of a new country,
it's a big thing.
Like, yeah. They don't just crank those out all the time, you know?
Totally.
So yeah. And he knew who needed to hear what. That was a big part of his appeal, was he knew who he was talking to. Probably one of the most cognizant, aware dudes we've ever covered. So going back in his early life, before we get into the scam, John Acca Blamaza was born just Acca Blamaza. I found out the term christened, like, oh, we christened him this, is cognate to like Christian name. I didn't ever think about that. So he goes by John, and John Acca is what a lot of people know him as. But he was born in 1941 in a coastal village in the West African country of Ghana. The political turmoil he would eventually use as camouflage for his scam unfolded in the 1950s, meaning that he would have been in his early teens, the very oldest, when he was supposed to be becoming a confidant to Kwame Nkrumah. But appears no one stopped to do the math, and also he wisely aged himself up.
Yeah.
He was like, no, I'm actually this old. And they're just like, oh, I'm at some fucking rich Philadelphia housewife was just like, you guys just don't age.
Right. Totally.
You look so good for 54. He's like, yeah, well, what can I say? You know, black don't crack, baby. But he, so as a boy, they called him Kerosene Boy. Cause he sold kerosene in discarded glass bottles. So that's, Ghana's chief import is nicknames. Actually, they don't do them very well. They got to bring those in from elsewhere. So from a young age, he was known to, like, he was one of those like bullshitter kids, like a Napoleon Dynamite kind of kid. Like, I had to go hunt wolverines with my uncle, a teller of tall tales. Yeah. So eventually at the age of 18, he traveled to America and eventually landed in Philly. And so he had told his family and his new friends in America that he was pursuing a college degree at Penn, joining the wave of African immigrants seeking a higher education in the city of brotherly love. At this point, Lincoln University, another college there, had more African students enrolled in the 1950s than any other college in the United States. Many of them were wealthy, and some even came from royal families. And this is when you started to see the proliferation of a lot of African princes showing up in Philly, you know, because it was just like, and the author of this book, her name is Yakiba Yibo. She was like, she pointed out that, like, I think she says, quote, I think for a lot of people, it's easier to present yourself like an exotic version of yourself as an African prince than it is to just be a black person in general, which is a sad truth. I mean, like, I got, you know, I can't just be a black dude coming here to go to college. I got to have a story. Yeah. So, and I remember when I was in Germany, we lived in the military base, and we would have like a lot of international students because, you know, if somebody is like an attaché or working with the U.S. government, their kids are with them, they go to our school. And my sister went to school with these two girls that were from Ghana, now that I think about it, and they were saying that they were princesses. And my family, like, if they were lying, who knows? My family, hook, line, and sinker. I never got a chance to meet them, but I would, like, my sister would be like, yeah, I'm going to go hang out with, I forget their names, and I'd just be like, hang out with royalty. I was always, I was always so jealous. I was like, when am I going to see these girls?
Well, it's also like, I mean, when you think about it in terms of, okay, so it's probably like the wealthy people who are sending their kids to get educated abroad, right? And like, maybe those people come from families that are very well established in that country, and that's why they have money. And there's no royal family, but you're like, I'm not going to explain the position of my family in Ghanaian society to these Americans. I'm just going to say I'm a prince. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I'm a prince. Yeah, yeah.
It's like a lot of times, like, there's sort of some vague reference to, like, being some kind of tribal leader. Like, that's a thing when you're talking about African people. But a lot of times it's just like, yeah, they're from a rich family. And, like, the rich families in every country run everything. So it's the easiest to just say, yeah, I'm a prince or whatever. Like, we're a tribal leader in the sense that, like, every society is made of tribes and, like, I'm from a rich one. Like,
We, in Killeen, there was a big Samoan population, and my my pawn shop boss, her friend, basically she's this guy, and he was technically a king, mm-hmm. but basically what it was he was like, a community leader, and he was, him and some other investors had been granted this island in the Samoan island chain. And so, yeah, and it was like, but it was like, you know, it was like a lot of work. It was like, they had to go clear it out, and they're trying to like make it, you know, trying to build it up. And he's like, yeah, technically you can say I'm a king, but he's like, it's just, I'm a business administrator. Like,
right,
I'm just a guy in the community, and I have some investors, and like, you know, he was super not scammy about it. But Blaise Meisel was not royal or even a student.
By the way, I just want to ask, what is the name of this book that's coming out?
The book is called, it's called Anansi's Gold.
Okay, cool.
Anansi's Gold.
Anansi's Gold. Yeah, it's by
a, her name is Yakuba Yibo, cool. And she is a Ghanaian English journalist, cool. This is her first book. So yeah, definitely go check it out. I stumbled across this without time to read an entire book. So, he had told his family and his new friends in America that he was pursuing an education, but in actuality, he was not a royal or even a student. While his roommates went off to class, he worked at the Union League of Philadelphia. It's a private club for the city's wealthiest and most influential residents.
Good place for an aspiring scammer to hang out.
Yeah, exactly. He said it was there that he studied what money and power looked like. You know, he's like, you know, laying the groundwork for his decades-long scheme. So at one point, he travels back to Ghana, and he gets back to Philadelphia in 1972, and he's presenting himself as a doctor with diplomatic ties. Mm-hmm. He ends up checking into the Bellevue Hotel in Philadelphia, a very high-scale place, and he runs up, and I love when you look at like the dollar like inflation amounts or whatever, he ran up $2,700 in 1972 money.
Nice.
That's like, yeah, I believe like that's a 4-year college education. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, he ran up a $2,700 bill at the Bellevue, was arrested at the hotel after they discovered that the Ghanaian embassy would not, in fact, be covering the expense. And Blaise Meisel claimed it was all a big misunderstanding, but that couldn't save him from a nearly year-long sentence at Greaterford State Prison. And it would have been longer were it not for the prison chaplain, a guy named Reverend James Edward Woodruff. And he was one of the first Americans to buy into Blaise Meisel's tall tales. The basic story, which would change many times over the decades, is as follows. Was that Blaise Meisel had been a close ally of Ghana's President Nkrumah, who had become that country's first leader after the new nation had declared independence from Great Britain. He was deposed in a coup in 1966 that had CIA fingerprints all over it, and he eventually died in exile in 1972. What's funny is, like, if he died in exile in 1972 in Bucharest in Romania, and this is where Blaise Meisel claimed that he was at his bedside.
Yep.
But in 1972, he was in prison with this guy he was telling the story to. And that's just because you couldn't Google shit. You couldn't.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And like people, I mean, like you said, it exploits the sort of ignorance of your average American to anything going on with Africa or African countries or anything. So he's saying, this is the part of the story that he does tell this guy. He says, I was at Nkrumah's deathbed to this chaplain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. To this chaplain. And the guy's like, well, among, I'm sure a bunch of other tales.
Sure. Sure.
And that's what he tells him, that before he passed, the president had entrusted him, Blaise Meisel, with the deed to the secret fortune. Millions. Well, it started off as millions, and then it was like, did I say millions? I meant billions. I meant this dude gave me billions. And it was in gold that Nkrumah had smuggled out of the country into a Swiss bank. And it was the key to Ghana's future, as they put it. It was just all the money they ever had.
Yeah.
History has painted Nkrumah as, depending on how you look at him, either he was like, I should say not history, but this story paints him as either like a thief. Like, there's people who could hear this story and be like, whoa, he took all the gold and like ran out of the country before he's deposed. Like, so yeah, there's people who do like him and people that don't like him. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in this story, this story falls into each narrative, however you want it to.
Sure.
You know, either he saved the day or he ruined it. Mm-hmm. But so the background on what Ghana was going through at the time and kind of like why it was so unstable, why it was a place where you could make a lot of shit up about and nobody would check, was that so, and also just the fact of why it was in such financial bad shape. And I don't think it takes, you know, I think we all know what's coming. why a West African country formerly out of British rule was in financially bad shape.
Yeah.
But essentially, In 1952, the West African nation of Ghana, recently having freed itself from British imperialism, set out on a project of radical economic ambition. It attained political independence with the creation of a sovereign parliament and executive office called the Convention People's Party, under the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah. It drew up extensive plans for ensuring the conditions of conditions were necessary for real, not just on paper, independence. And that meant independence of the agricultural and industrial sectors from domination by European capital. Mm-hmm. But now the thing is this why one thing that I found out in researching this and a little bit before this was, like, you always wonder, like, why aren't things so bad in these third world countries or other parts of, like, why is there no infrastructure? You know, why is that? Well, what drew all the interest to these places, of course, was their resources. And I was watching a video about how it basically they're not set up for resource development or resource enrichment or resource manufacturing. They're set up for resource extraction.
Yep.
So all of their shit, like some of these places had two paved roads for a significant portion of their history. And it was like from a gold mine to the coast,
yeah.
From from like a cocoa plantation to the coast.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was like, it was like, well, the people actually live here, here, and here. We don't give a shit. You know, right. Those urban centers are going to crumble.
Some roads for them to get to the place where they're mining the gold.
Yeah. But we don't care. Did you see where they're at? It is late. Yeah. Yeah. They should be here by now. I don't know why they're not here, actually. But that was like, you know, that was the problem that it had. Also, Ghana's chief export was cocoa and gold and timber was their main resources of revenue. And as in many developed countries, these products were exported in unprocessed form. So all manufacture and processing materials was done by industries in Europe and the United States. Mm-hmm. So money from exports went to wealthy plantation owners in Ghana who had little incentive to invest in productive areas.
Right.
So the wealthy countries created jobs. Like, there's lumber mills in America. There's, you know, people who are processing cocoa all over the world. And then, like, there's a country that actually sells the cocoa in its raw form, and they're just getting the one-time transaction. Like, hey, there you go. Thanks. Maybe pay a couple guys to drive it, but it's like, it's not creating jobs.
Right.
It's not creating, you know, financial power or growth in any way.
Right.
And so that was the state that it was left in after British rule. So because of this, because of this instability, he's able to spin this tale to this prison warden or prison chaplain. And this dude buys it hook, line, and sinker and was like, I'm going to get you out of here. And he was connected into a lot of powerful people in Philadelphia's black community.
Mm-hmm.
And so he introduced him to a construction company owner named Robert Ellis. And you had mentioned about the, like, Pan-Africanism and black power movements and, like, in the 70s. This was right around that time. Here's a very successful black guy who's, like, in the city. He's, you know, he's like, it's not just, you know, in retail. He's, like, doing construction. He's building shit. He's, like, you know, ahead of the city.
Yeah.
And a community leader. There you go. Why couldn't I think of that term? I was like, he's a guy in charge. I don't know. But yeah, so they introduce him, and together, Blaise Miza and Robert Ellis established what's called the Office for the Bureau of African Affairs and Industrial Development. Sounds like a governmental agency.
Right.
It's actually just an import-export company. It's completely, it's Federal Express.
They're sort of doing the same thing that the name of their company professes them not to be doing, which is developing infrastructure in Ghana,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is the whole thing that you said. Like, they don't have that. They just have abilities to export. It's all entirely extractive. And so these guys are also further extracting, but they've named it something that sounds like...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, African Affairs and Industrial Development. Yeah, it's...
I don't know if you get into this or not in what you read, but I'm imagining if Nkrumah was overthrown in a coup that probably had something to do with the CIA, my guess is that he probably tried to nationalize those industries. Is that right?
That was it. Yeah, he was...
That's the main way. If you want the CIA to come hang out with you... be a recently independent country and nationalize a commercial industry. They will be there very quickly, and you will get to post. That's our favorite thing to do.
But that's like I listened to that Blowback podcast about Cuba and Castro, and like, I always, you know, like, I unlearned a lot of things that I was told growing up. As the older that you get, I think most sensible people do that. But, like, one of the ones that I was always just like, nah, Castro probably sucked, you know what I'm saying? Or, like, Cuba probably was bad. Like, that was one of those things that I just was, like, a given that, like, I'm pretty sure I'd gotten the story on. Mm-hmm. And then I actually heard it, and I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, man. Like, I knew it wasn't outside the realm of possibility. Like, maybe I'd fed a different story. But I actually, by learning about all that, that was pretty mind-blowing. I was like, oh, wow, that's... Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Cuba is like, it's a really fascinating case. And it's interesting because, like, obviously there is the sort of American diplomatic interest to keep Americans thinking Cuba is bad after the whole Cold War and everything. I mean, particularly during that, like, it makes total, like, there's a real sort of political interest in keeping people thinking that Cuba's bad. And then also, most of the people that immigrated from Cuba at that time are like, yeah. Dude, let me tell you about how bad Cuba is. They kicked me out. They took my family's sugar plantation. And so you're like, wow, Cuba sounds really bad. They took your family's sugar plantation. That's terrible. And then you find out, like, oh, yeah, the people working on that plantation rose up and overthrew you, basically.
It wasn't just, you guys weren't just, like, having, like, the happy, fun time sugar land.
But, yeah, I do feel like if you want a shortcut to understanding American foreign policy, if any country nationalized something and then immediately fell, we did that. That's, like, a good sort of global policy to understand. But anyway,
Man, dude, that was a crazy one. Well, a bunch of our friends, of our comedian friends, just took a trip to Cuba, and they said it was fun, but it was definitely a lot of people just like trying to sell you stuff. But their way in is like, they're like, hey man, we love America. It's all politics. Fuck that shit. People for people. But anyways, here's a $400 coconut statue or whatever. Like, so they're coming around to capitalism, and everybody's very happy.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, Cuba has problems for sure. They're still, you know, a lot of poor people there, and it's still like they lack a lot of the infrastructure we have. But also, it's like, yeah, because the U.S. has had sanctions against them for 100 years.
Yeah, that's what when I was really like looking at it, was like all these things like, oh, well, you want communism? Look how it's working over here. How it's working over here. It's like all these countries that we've had our fucking we've had our foot on their necks for the last 40 years, you know, like, or 60 years. Yeah. It doesn't like that. That was a big learning thing for me. It was like, I read a book also called How to Hide an Empire. Mm-hmm. That was really good. Recently, it kind of says the same thing.
I'll check that out. That sounds good.
Yeah, that was a really good one. I saw it on just literally like a leftist book list, and I was touring, and I was like, well, I have 24 hours to listen to an audiobook. Let's go.
Nice.
So, Blaise Mazzi, so they established the Bureau of African Affairs and Industrial Development, import-export company, the oxymoron. It was designed to resemble an actual government agency. From their headquarters in Bala Cynwyd, Ellis and Blaise would sign new investors to the so-called Oman Ghana Trust Fund. Not Oman the country. I guess Oman in their language literally just means our country. So it's the Our Country Ghana Trust Fund.
Okay.
Now, here's the... That plays a very important part, because that is the actual business that people are buying into. That's the heart, that's the legs of the scam over the next 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So many were lawyers or business owners who were also promised lucrative contracts with the Ghanaian government.
Right.
But as business continued, and this is where I say it turns into like a little more just run-of-the-mill predatory shit, where it's not so much rob from the rich and give to the poor. He started the list. Foreign students, elderly widows, you know, people with retirement funds roped into the scheme as well. So it wasn't just the wealthy that he was hitting, but all were told that their investment would help Blaise clear the necessary red tape to bring the money home to Ghana, and that they would be repaid tenfold, perhaps even 20. When the initial payment date passed, there was always an excuse, a promise of a still greater return and request for more money. So it did sound like a lot of these people let their greed overtake their common sense. Because if a guy told you he's going to get you 10% return, and then he doesn't have it for you, he tells you to give him 6 months and he'll give you 20. Like, you know, like that ball is really in your court at that point.
Like, yeah. But like, with the right sort of, you know, I always think of, you know, the original original meaning of the word glamour was to kind of like, smoke screen and mystify someone with, like, you know, it originally was like a magic, like talking about specifically magic, but like, just to like do a glamour on someone, like make them think something else is going on, like distract them with something shiny and nice. That's what's happening when you're getting told this stuff and you're still believing it. Is like,
you've
been glamoured.
You're definitely getting victimized for sure. Like that dude's running game on you.
Yeah, with some very clever misdirection. You know, like, I'd imagine he's very adept at managing people in this way.
Yeah, it seems so. There's we'll get to it a bit. He got interviewed by Ed Bradley for 60 Minutes, and it is a hilarious interview.
Is it after he's been like nailed, like after they know he's a scammer?
After he knows he's a scammer, and he does not give a shit, nice. and he just completely is like, everyone else is lying. It's gold, and like in that, it's Ed Bradley too, because the dude really puts on, like he's like, you know, obviously I'm sure he is very respectful of his country's traditions, but it feels like he really knows how to crank up the Africa to 11.
Yeah. I think like especially during that time period when like if this is like in the 60s and 70s, there are a lot of like newly independent nations in Africa. Like,
yeah,
it's like a very politically fraught time for that part of the world. And it's sort of like emerging attitudes about it in America. Like, I can totally see him playing up that attitude to like, yeah, get like overly reverent white liberals and also Black Americans who are interested in like Pan-Africanism. And like, yeah, it's a perfect storm of people to swindle.
Yeah, time and place. It's like, you know, they talk about like the great man theory in history, and it's like there's a theory that like great men come along and make changes, or that there's like the counterpoint of that. It's like, no, like when the circumstances are right, it will like a type of person gets produced.
Yes, and the times make the man. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
is
yeah.
True, that is true of scam artists as well, for sure.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. This guy, yeah, he was of the time. There's in that scene, an interview, it shows him, he took like a lot of his really rich Philadelphia like lawyer and doctor investors, and he's at the, like this like conference room, and there's just like an African dance troupe, and they're just like crazy, and these people are, it's like early 80s, so they have like the suits and stuff, they're just like, oh wow, like the looks on their faces, it's hilarious.
You just unlocked a memory for me that I totally forgot about, that now I need to like investigate. Where so I grew up in New Hampshire, which is very white, very very white, and when I was in fifth grade, a guy came and taught us African dance, and we did like an African dance recital. All these little white kids in, we made traditional African clothes. Like, I remember like in art class, we did like these tie-dye project, and all these little white 10-year-olds did this African dance. And like, there was like African drumming and stuff. And maybe that was also a scam artist, but now I'm just like, man, they really, that would not happen now. Like, I think you would get in trouble now. I think.
Yeah.
That era of multiculturalism has passed, I think. I don't think you're allowed to do that anymore. Even though it was like really fun and we learned about Africa and like it was cool. Don't think we'd be doing it now. I think we'd be learning about Africa in some other way, perhaps.
Yeah, a different capacity. That'd be hilarious if that dude was just making that shit up. He was just like, he was just
totally. I want to like find out like what his deal was. He was he was a dude who like lived in town, and I'm sure. I'm very curious.
Oh, I always got like a Lyle Landley impression. Like, he just came into town. He was just like, hey, it's the one black guy in New Hampshire. Check this out. I got a way to fill an afternoon for you.
Yeah. I got to like ask my parents about that. Like, what was the deal with that? Why did that happen? I mean, it was public school. Like, I don't know.
Dude, this one mystery just confounds me. And I hope that when you die, you just find everything out. I don't know what happens, but I hope you just get all the information. Like, oh, that's where I left my keys. Shit like that.
Sure.
And like, but like this one time, we had a guy, a substitute teacher, come to our school in fourth grade in El Paso, and he was like, you guys know UPS? He asked about UPS, and we were like, yeah, you know about UPS. He goes, okay, so UPS treats their employees really bad, and I used to work there, and they were really mean to me, and so we're going to do like we're all going to draw pictures making fun of UPS, and like literally he was like, done nothing bad, he was like, for example, it might be like, hey, UPS, you donkeys, and we'll draw a donkey wearing a UPS thing. He literally did that on the chalkboard, and we all drew an anti-UPS picture. And passed it up to the front, and then like he was gone, and 2 weeks later he stopped back by, and our normal teacher was there, and he goes, hey, I was one of the substitutes, I just came by to check up, and I overheard her, and she goes, yeah, that doesn't normally happen, normally substitute teachers don't stop back by and check up, and you can tell she was mad suspicious of this guy, and I'm just like, did he just show back up to his old UPS job, like, fuck you, kids hate you? Like, I don't know,
very curious.
Very strange.
They're like about to strike, so that guy's cool. That guy was, yeah. But yeah, I would love to know that guy's deal was.
Yeah, I think about that a lot these days. I wonder. I would like to see if I looked at the UPS strike, like some older Latino man. That's about how old he'd be now. Yeah. With like a sign that's like UPS, you donkeys, and he's like.
Keep an eye out, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. If you see that, yeah, send it to the Twitter at LCS Podcast. But so yeah, so in addition to swindling many Philadelphians out of their money, this dude, he just did a bunch of wild, like just scam con artist shit. Blame Isaac definitely married to solve his immigration problem.
Sure.
That was first things first for a guy like that. But this is just kind of cool and also a little scary and showing how things have changed. He was able to steal college degrees. So I think he had like all sorts of degrees from these universities. And it was because he used to live with a guy named Jacob Badu, who was another African guy who came over here, and he actually got like a master's from Penn. He got like all these mm-hmm. very prestigious degrees. And Blame Isa just contacted Penn and said, "Hey, it's Jacob Badu. I changed my name. Can you guys reprint my fucking things for him?" And it was all it took was an $11 administrative fee. They were like, "Yeah, we got you, man." Wow. So he had like, yeah, he
didn't have to provide documentation or anything. They were just like, "Yep, you changed
over the
your
phone."
Name.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
What a time to be alive. Yeah.
Man. People had it easy back then. Why wasn't everyone doing that?
Yeah.
You could get like 8 people to all share one degree. It would be great.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Penn. Yeah, no, I changed it back. I changed it back to fucking to Bill. I'll need that back.
Yeah.
I'm just so frickin' indecisive. So, here we go. Yeah, so I did want to read, just kind of like to get like the, Yepica Yebo, she wrote an excerpt of her book in a Town and Country article, and just to kind of give an idea of how he was running game on these people. Mm-hmm. This was a standard business meeting that he had set up for his investors in the Omen Ghana Trust Fund, and he had invited them to the Channel Islands at this like luxury resort.
Nice.
And so this is an excerpt from the book, just kind of showing what like the razzle dazzle he would put on these people.
Mm-hmm.
So. "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Guernsey," said the flight attendant as the tiny plane descended over a patchwork of brown-green fields and coastline. The Oman Ghana Trust Fund had come to the Channel Islands. The investors trooped across the tarmac into the airport, carrying suitcases and wrapped in trench coats, wearing looks of grim determination. Guernsey was cold, wet, and miserable, and so were they. But they had been told that the trust fund would finally be paying out. But the small group of Ghanaian, South Korean, American, and British supporters was subdued. It had been years, and there was none of the excitement of previous trips. So he's been taking them out, and now it's like losing the luster.
Yeah.
Like they're like, I guess they used to go like way cooler places. Now they're in a fucking, you know, like a rainy British island. And,
it's not the first place I would go for like a luxurious vacation. I bet it's very nice, but but you can tell this is trip number something.
Yeah.
It's not the first.
Boy,
time.
Yeah, they serve cod so many different ways. You're not even gonna know what to do with all the salted cod you're about to eat on this fucking vacation. So the tiny island of Guernsey, marooned in the English Channel off the coast of France, had long been a center of offshore banking and a favorite resort for American grifters. Phil Wilson, a con man from St. Louis, ran the Bank of Sark on Guernsey in the late 1960s. The operation was, in its entirety, quote, "a mail drop, a telex machine, and a barmaid," and it made millions. Blame Isa had flown in ahead of the investors and was situated in a suite at the La Grande Mar, a relatively new hotel on the West Coast. Mary Lou Valenote, Blame Isa's secretary from Philadelphia, had also landed earlier. Now she ushered new arrivals through a set of white double doors and into the reception room of Blame Isa's suite, where they all settled in overstuffed sofas. New Jersey businessman Walter Hajduk, who they said they got him for $7 million. That guy gave him
That's right.
$7 million in early 80s money. Like, I can't stress that enough.
So he was, they had
Walter Hajduk. There was Peter Rigby, Edium Stevens, and there was this guy Stevens is a police officer sent by the Ghanaian government to monitor Blame Isa's overseas travels. That's how much they don't trust him.
Yeah.
So Athlete Kim Chung Han, part of Blamize's entourage, translated for the South Korean investors. In a second, smaller sitting room, Blamize dressed casually in a red patterned shirt and light slacks. Also, this dude was like dressed to the nines all the time. If it wasn't in like completely tailored suits from Lloyd's of London and shit, this dude was rocking like straight up like traditional African tribal gear.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, always
he has
dripping,
the drip
100%.
In all countries. In all cultures. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The universal language of drip.
Yeah.
And so in a second smaller room, Blamize was dressed. Yeah. So almost every one of them. Now, these guys were all dressed in like dark wool suits, very 80s, very brown.
Sure.
So at one point he showed them the Ghanaian national handshake, which I'm like almost 100% sure he made up. He was like, yeah, then we do a flip flap, come back
up.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Then I run around you. You run around me. We're going to do a figure eight. And then we high five at the end. And these white people were just like, no, okay. They're all just dancing totally. Along with that shit. Yeah. So he showed me the handshake. So the investors spend most of this brief trip in their suites gossiping or wandering around the island in the rain, waiting for something to happen. And although he spent a great deal of his time living in hotels, Blamize hated hotel food. So he traveled with a personal chef. Oh, this dude lived like a king. He traveled with a personal chef who brought ingredients straight from Ghana and cooked only for him. A lot of times he would make these like crazy stews that you had to cook for hours, and the hotel staff would just be like, hey, man, the whole place smells like goat. You know what I'm saying? Like, what are you doing, dog? And, like, he would just be like, oh, yeah, sorry. Go look at how much money I pay you. And they were like,
right.
Solid
yeah, yeah.
point. Yeah. Yeah, but they were constantly, like, opening windows and just, like, trying to air out places.
So at least these people's money was going to a good cause, which is this guy eating good and dressing nice.
Yeah. This dude, there's mad photos of him smoking a cigar.
Hell
and he
yeah.
smokes a cigar like he's ripping you off. You can just tell the way he smokes that cigar.
That is a real, like... Yeah. There is a way to smoke a cigar where you know someone is scamming. It's a good look.
Yeah, yeah, and he's doing it, and boy, he's wearing it. sooner than usual, the word came from Blamize. The money's still locked up. There'd be another delay. Blamize had his Louis Vuitton trunks packed again and headed back to London. The investors straggled after him. It's become very awkward, one complained. Blamize, as usual, had not explained much about what had gone wrong. On the way back to London, the investors filled in the rest of wild speculation. But as they all said, Blamize was a financial wizard. They all agreed on that. So the fault must have lain with some arcane banking role.
If he didn't know how to be good with money, how would he afford these cigars? Frankly, it's obvious.
Yeah. If this guy wasn't good with money, why'd I give him all my money? You think
right.
about that, right?
You know, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, he's not good with money. He got $7 million out of me. He must be doing something right.
Right.
Miza had not explained. On the way back to London, they were all kind of wondering, like, what the hell happened. Reed, one of his investors, was under the impression that the funds had been trapped in five banks for decades now. Mm-hmm. Hajduk interrupted. The other guy was like, no, it's 16 banks. So they've been telling them all the numbers of banks. Because as Homeboy said, he was like, these 16 banks. Now, if you take 27 billion and 27 billion, 800 million, right? That means that each of these banks has a billion and a half, he said. So the money was all transferred to five banks. Now, those banks have it now, one of which is Butterworth, he said, in Bermuda. It turns out there is a bank in Bermuda called NT Butterfield and Son. But
okay.
This dude, yeah, he just fucked it up and called it Butterworth. He's like, look, I got it in Butterworth. I got half an Uncle Ben. You know? And so the Jemima index is all up and down these days. But, so he goes, all right, so look, he was like, the banks also, they needed me to sweeten the deal for them. So I went ahead and kicked them a little bit of bread, so I'm going to need that back from you guys. Now, it's going to be 50 bank days. Now, that's some 75 regular days, including weekends. Reed, a British investor, was like, man, look, we're in a lot of shit now, is what he told me. He goes, wait, I haven't got a credit card that I can use. And then fucking, you know, Homeboy, a couple people were like, you know, you do what you want. The Hodgduck guy who was in for $7 million was like, look, I don't even care anymore. This is when things were kind of starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like how things were going on. But Ellis continued to run the scheme in Philly for years. And until state prosecutors finally caught up to him in 1986, after losing patience with Blamize's excuses, one of the investors, a Philly lawyer named Barry Ginsburg, had contacted... Barry Ginsburg sounds like a record executive. Anyways, but Barry Ginsburg had contacted an assistant district attorney for Philadelphia. Ellis was arrested in January. This is Robert Ellis. This is the construction guy who was his partner. Mm-hmm. Was arrested in January of 86. And and hauled him to court later that spring. He stood trial before Judge Lynn Abraham, who would also go on to become Philly's first female attorney general. They said that, yeah, she was super hardcore. She carried a gun, drank 3 cups of coffee a day, and was an outspoken supporter of the death penalty. This crazy, caffeinated, gun-wielding bitch with a horrible accent, pronouncing it turlet. Just a real, real bang-up job all around. But so prosecutors that estimated that in the Philadelphia area, he had swindled about 300 people. And though those were amazingly just the victims willing to talk, as we know, a lot of people don't come forward with stuff like
this. Right. Yeah, yeah. People get so embarrassed they don't even say that this happened to them.
Completely understandable. They had more than $15 million collectively, but that's a drop in the bucket to the, at the minimum, this dude got $100 million. $100 million is the agreed upon. Some people say it's as high as 300.
Yeah.
Yeah. And reportedly, he had scammed people from all over the world. At this point, an arrest warrant was issued for Blame Iza, but he was already out of the country. So then he goes, this is where shit goes, like, elevates him from, like, you know, normal story to just, like, God tier status. So he's back in Ghana, and while in Ghana, he gets charged with financial crimes against the state. So essentially, he tries to swindle the state government. It may have had something to do with the whole Ghana trust thing.
Probably.
He was talking about how, I would imagine.
If he's, like, trying to represent himself as somehow affiliated with the state, and he's not, and he's like, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, that carried that carried the death penalty in Ghana.
Oh, so shit. Okay.
Yeah, so this dude was on death row. And so this is what he does, basically. He's just like, he convinces them to let him go and to go to London as a diplomatic emissary to try to work to get some of this money that he's got out there. Because he's like, I got money. Don't worry about how I got it. I got it, though.
Yeah.
All right? And you guys are going to let me go get it because, hey, Ghana, do you have a lot of money? Oh, that's right. You don't. You guys don't have a lot of money. I do. I'll go get some of my money. And so they took him out of death.
He basically pulls the scam on him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where he's like, hey, I have a lot of money. It's tied up in a bank in another country. Let me go get it. Which is exactly the scam he was running on the individual people. He runs on Ghana itself.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
At one point in his life, this is when he was still, I believe he was still in Ghana, he got charged with some kind of fraud or something. And he was like, you know what? Look, you're right. I did this. Take me to the bank. I'll get the money out. I'll pay you back. And the cops drove him to the bank, and he escaped through the bathroom window.
Of course he did.
Yeah, I was like, man, I don't think he's coming out of that bank. I think I fucked up.
That's
letting him go in that bank.
The Indian guy we covered did that too.
Yeah.
Warlaw did that. Yeah.
That one, we had a lot of views on that video on the TikTok and the Facebook. So yeah, that was a international hit. But so he goes to London, and then while in London, he has diplomatic immunity. So he can't get arrested in London.
Yeah, because
he's canceled
there
because
Ghana sent him there.
And he's got tons of British investors. So there's people in Britain that want his ass.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And he's there, and he's, you know, he lives in a fucking beautiful penthouse in London. He drives a Rolls Royce. Also, the cop that arrested him in Ghana is working for him now.
That's like
his security guy. And so he's just there. So they end up doing an interview with this guy on 60 Minutes. And they send a young Ed Bradley who still looks old. And R.I.P. Ed Bradley. I didn't know he died all the way back in 2005.
R.I.P.
So, R.I.P. So he goes to, he's in the 60 Minutes interview. He starts off the interview by coming in and he sits Ed Bradley in a regular ass chair, and then he pulls out a throne. And sits in the throne. He's done up and he goes, before we start, I need to do an ancient Ghanaian ritual that is that we do before we speak the truth. And he takes a sip of water and takes a sip of water and like spits it into like these like wooden blade looking things, and one of them is it's 3 gulps, 3 spits, and it stands for see no evil, speak the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I don't think that's
again
a saying.
I don't
Ghana.
Know. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that seems very, very Western. So, and he sits down, and he's like, basically, he's like, look, I work for the Ghanaian government. You know, I do Like they have me here on as an emissary. He was like, so what about like, you know, all the people who say you never get their money? He's like, yeah, the money's coming. He just completely denies everything. Course, he's like, the money's on the way. And he was like, yeah, I'm good with the Ghanaian government. Here's the one thing he had to do, though. They were like, yeah, you can get back out there, do your thing. We don't give a shit. But you can't mention Kwame Nkrumah. So you can't mention the ex-president. So he had to take his name off the sales pitch. Furthermore, he had to retroactively go back and be like, I never said it was him who gave me the fucking money.
That's where the money comes from, yeah.
Yeah, and he does it with just ease. Like he's like, so why are, it's like Ed Bradley is just mystified by this guy. He's like, why are they saying that you said it was the president? All these, like, I don't know. I don't know. He's like, things, rumors start, things get built up. But no, that was all hearsay. If you speak it straight to me, I would have told you that it came from my ancestors. And he's like, all right, well, how'd they get the money? And he goes, can't disclose that. That's, you know, this dude, again, pretty cool. Now, at one point, he got arrested in London for bribery. Or no, he got arrested back in Ghana for bribery, to bribe a government official. One of his investors, and a guy, a former U.S. attorney, John Mitchell of Watergate infamy, was one of this guy's marks. Okay. He scammed him. And this dude was so sold on him that he came, was like, hey, man, like I'll fucking... he came and basically vouched for him on his behalf and got him out of prison over in Africa. And that guy, yeah, also John Mitchell, one of his guys, they were like, how much money did John Mitchell give you? And he goes, he's never given me money, but he's given me his time, which is valuable. And so he's like, basically got this dude running errands for his ass. His partner, however, back in America, Ellis, Rob Ellis, got popped with everything.
Yeah.
He took like all the 100% charges, full rollout, 5 to 15 years in prison. He was arrested again in 1992 for tax evasion. Sounds like he put a cloud over that dude's whole fucking life. Yeah. Well, I mean, that guy was doing it too. It wasn't like he was getting scammed also. Like he was in on it.
He was in on it, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, it sucks. This dude, so
but
he
they
leaves.
Took it out on him because they couldn't get.
Yeah, because they couldn't get him. It wasn't like he was hiding like off the grid. He was living in London, driving a Rolls Royce.
With
like,
diplomatic immunity. Yeah, with his old guard working for him. Yeah.
Yeah. They so he ended up, so he did pass away in Accra, the capital of Ghana, under house arrest. Given his many endless spins, though, and many feigned heart attacks, this is the thing you're going to get to. This guy was real quick to be like, oh, the cops are, ah! And he was just like immediately,
awesome.
He was like, made like no hesitation to fake a heart attack. So it was a scheme that at various points, so. Because of all of his scheming, people were like, I don't know if he's really dead. And finally, the Ghanaian government, at the request of the FBI, obtained fingerprints from his corpse.
because people, they're just like, Andy Kaufman of scamming. Like, people don't think he's really dead. Yeah.
So, this is one of those scams that, up until the very end, he had hardcore believers that were still like, no, this
he's
is going to be good.
He's coming through. He's got the money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. It was a scheme that at various points involved not just average Philadelphians, but the prominent figures like nightclub owner Ben Bynum, and like I said, even John Mitchell, the former U.S. Attorney General, disgraced by his involvement in Watergate. Everyone wanted to believe in the treasure buried in the Swiss vaults, which could instantly uplift Ghana after years of colonialism, bloody coups, and make them fabulously wealthy in the process. But it just looks, as the years tick on and we're, you know, close to 40 years after his death, I don't think it's going to happen. But worth it? 100%.
Yeah,
totally.
Sounds like he did end up in house arrest, you said. So something happened.
Yeah, but
at a certain age,
is house arrest just like, what are we going to do?
You're just
hanging out at the crib. I mean, like, I don't know. It feels like he had a really good time in the meantime.
Yeah, it does.
So, yeah, that is the story of John Aka Blamiza. And yeah, go check it out. And again, that book, it's called Anansi's Gold. That is out. Go read that for me. I couldn't. Tell me about it. Yeah, if you guys are just tuning in, like I said, we do two of these for free every month. And we also have two more episodes available on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/liecheatandsteal. Get you access to our whole back catalog as well as our Discord. You can follow us on Twitter at LCS Podcast and on TikTok at Lie Cheat Steal Podcast. Kathy, got anything coming up for us?
Yeah, but I don't know when this is going to come out. So follow me on social media, Kath Barbadoro, B-A-R-B-A-D-O-R-O. I post all my dates on Twitter and Instagram. I do stand up in the New York City area. I have another podcast called What a Time to Be Alive that comes out every week. And I think that's it for me. What you got, Pat?
Let's see. Yeah, I'm going to be in the Velveeta Room all this weekend, but that may not be in time for you to hear that. So I have a new monthly show that I'm running at South Austin Comedy Club called Saturday Pint Live. And we're doing the second one. It's going to be on August 19th. That one we did like a standard like headliner, like guest feature headliner lineup last time. Now it's straight up showcase, six comics, 10 minutes each. Bang, you know, come through. And it's going to be a fun one. Also, I'll be in Oak Cliff in Dallas at La Privada on the 26th. So nice. You can come and catch me there as well. Yeah, that's all we got. Guys, thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you like what you hear, follow us on the Patreon. But if you're out there, you know, doing things, be safe, be smart. But above all, don't get caught.
Don't get caught. See you next time.